hartseer oomblik, die omstandighede waaronder ons vir dokter Suleiman hier gekry het. Maar groot voorreg is, ons het Suna Venter, die journalist in wie se naam hierdie lesing aangebied word. Ons het haar ouers en haar broer hier vandag. Hulle sit hier voor en dis vir ons 'n voorreg om hulle saam met ons hier te hê. Dr. Imtiaz Suleiman, dink ek, het nie veel bekendstelling nodig nie. Almal assosieer hom met Gift of the Givers. Dit is 'n organisasie wat ek dink ongelooflike werk doen en waarvan ons eintlik baie min weet. Die bietjie wat ek al gesels het met maatskappye wat betrokke is en hom steun, kom 'n mens agter die omvang van wat hulle doen is baie groter as die bietjie wat ons miskien in die media sien. En dat hulle dit alles doen, glad nie vir erkenning in die media nie, hulle doen dit om die werk gedoen te kry. Dit is my lekker om te sê, Dr. Suleiman will be receiving an honorary doctorate from the University of Stellenbosch, I think at the April... at the April ceremony, so you will see him around then again. He just flew into Cape Town, he might be flying out later again afterwards, so we'll have to see. But yeah, it's a big honor to have you here. Thank you so much for making time to be here today, and we look forward to listening to what you have to say. The topic, as you've seen in the booklet, is human, humane, humanity. It's something that we can associate with him, but I think it's also something that we saw in Suna's work, especially in her reportage from the Middle East, from what she experienced and what she told listeners about in coming back and sharing those experiences. So afterwards, there will be time for questions. Yeah, so we'll open up the floor then. Thank you.
Thank you, Frida. Philip, Krista, the family, very good to have you here under very difficult circumstances. Futa, Suna's boss, good to see you also. And all the people at Stellenbosch, thank you very much for being here this afternoon. It was the 29th of June, 12:27 in the afternoon, I sent a message. Hi, Suna. Hope you're fine. I'm at Bramley. Bramley is Gifts of the Givers Logistics Center in Johannesburg. Suna and I have been trying to meet each other for months. Either she's caught up in something in the radio station or gone out, or she was in hospital quite a few times, or I get caught up in something and we miss each other. That day, 12:27, I sent her the message, and I said to myself, it's taking long to get a reply. Either she's out on a story, or again, she's in hospital. I never questioned her too much about the personal life. At 5 o'clock, I get a call from my son, and 10 minutes later, I get a call from my wife. She say, both of them say, have you heard? Suna is no more. I get a shock. I'm standing in Bramley, and I go cold. It brings back to me the message that I sent to Yolandi Koki on the 6th of December, 2014. I said, Yolandi, it was 5:59 in the morning, Saturday, 6th December, 2014. I said, Yolandi, the waiting is almost over. In 2 hours, Pierre Koki was going to be in our hands, alive, free, released unconditionally. At 8 o'clock, I get a call that Pierre Koki is no more. The American troops went in, and both him and Luke Summers passed on. So when I got that message at 5 o'clock, I was in a state of shock. This was a repetition of what happened in 2014. Both Afrikaner, both wonderful people. I never met Pierre Koki. But just by talking to Yolandi and the amount of people that spoke to me about Pierre Koki, it was as if I knew him for years. And when I compared the two, both were spiritual people. Both were very people who had the world at their heart. And both of them were involved because of the Middle East. Pierre Koki was in Yemen, and Suna's love was for the Middle East. My acquaintance with Suna started in 2009, where I physically met her for the first time. We were on a mission to Gaza. The bombs were falling everywhere, but here was this young, beautiful Afrikaner journalist. What other journalists wanted to join our teams? And when she came in the bus, she was sitting next to my wife. And you could see that this person was very intense in her thought processes, in just the insight. And when you look at her face, you know that this person is very, very deep, not in a negative sense, but in a very positive sense, wanting to know about life. She didn't have to say a word, but you could assess that from just looking at her soul. We went through into Gaza, and when she saw the bombs and the destruction, we started understanding the real Sunnah Fenta. We didn't engage much because the journalists didn't come much to me. Everybody went to the other team members. Somehow, I don't know, they're afraid to come to me. In any case, when Sunnah spoke, it wasn't about covering the story. I have journalists and I have journalists. Five bombs fell, hospital destroyed, three children died, four people in emergency care, no water. That's the story. Some journalists write the story as it happens. Sunnah was the type of journalist who wanted to go beyond the story, behind the story. What's happening here? When did it start? How long has this been happening? Why is this happening? Who is responsible? What is the situation for so many years? Her human emotions came out. And we always say, don't get involved personally in a situation like that. Even as a journalist, you're supposed to be removed from the situation. But Sunnah's humanity overtook that. She couldn't bear to see the suffering of the people, the children, the women, old people. And she says, you know what? My people don't know about this. I knew who her people were, but I asked it deliberately. So who are your people? She said, the Afrikaner people. So I said, and what are you going to do about this? And what do you want to tell them? She said, I like to tell them the truth. And I said, how are you going to do that? She said, I work for RSG. The radio is in my hands. And I can promote the message and teach society about what the real situation is here. I'm independent. I'm Christian. I'm young. I'm a journalist and I'm an Afrikaner. Nobody's putting thoughts in my head to say what they want to say. It is what I've experienced, what I felt, and what I want to relate to the world. It is about the situation of human beings. And you then understood that this was a young girl who was compassionate, who had mercy, who was a human being, who was humane, and who cared about humanity. It didn't matter which religion, what color, what race, where you came from. It was about the passion of people caught up in difficulty. Sunnah fell in love with the Palestinians, and the Palestinians fell in love with Sunnah. She had that way around her. Even without having to say too many words, people just got attracted to her. The members on my team, the medical members, also saw for the first time. They fell in love with Sunnah. And the other media people also found Sunnah to be very sharing, very open, very honest, sincere and in integrity in whatever she did or said. She went around looking for stories all the time, not how many buildings got bombed, but behind the stories. And when she came back, she promoted that reality of what was happening in Gaza to the whole Afrikaner community and to the world. We fell in love with Sunnah. My teams fell in love with Sunnah. They said on the mission in Libya, when they went with her, again, it was a very intense situation. She was with us. We were in a place called Ajdabia. You have a lot of journalists who come. They want to be macho. They want to be hero. Oh, we want to go to the front line. I said, do you have any idea what the front line is all about? No, no, we want to go. And next minute, they see the journalists from other countries running from the front line into Ajdabia. I said, would you like to go? They said, no, we like to go in the opposite direction. So I said, do you know what's happening? The Libyan forces are coming closer. And where we are is very risky. And as everybody left, I said, we are not leaving now. So they asked when we are leaving. I said, we're going to do some cases in the hospital. A friend that was very close to Sunnah is a Cuban doctor. He's the number one man in my team. A guy called Dr. Levan Turino. Any mission you announce, before you announce the mission, Levan's message comes, Chief, my bags are packed, I'm ready. He's always ready. In that same hospital in Ajdabia, somebody dropped a hand grenade just not far from his feet. He survived. Lucky nothing happened to my team members. And we said we need to work in this hospital. And 2 hours after that time, I said we now have to move. And immediately after we moved, the bombs fell in that area. Soon I wanted to know what spiritual message was behind this. How did you know? I said, Sunnah, I don't know. I don't know how I know. Because my spiritual teacher, on 6 August 1992 in Istanbul told me, "My son, that in everything that you do, you will know. I'm doing this for 26 years. Believe me, in everything that I do know. Not because I is I, because he told me something else. He said, whatever you do is done through you and not by you. And if you open yourself out for that, the divine mercy flows through you. And you can guide your teams." And Suna caught on to that immediately. She saw on to that immediately because her heart was receptive for divine messages. It was not a Muslim trying to make a Christian another Muslim. No. We got 1.6 billion already. It's too much. So we're not interested in that. We were there to show how people across color, coming from an apartheid past, coming from a South Africa that divided us, yet our humanity and our souls brought us together. Where we could share things together. We never looked at, oh, you're from the African state before 1994. That never crossed us. You're a human, not you are white. You're a journalist. You're Afrikaner, no. Suna, you're a human being, and I'm a human being. You're a Christian and I'm Muslim, didn't matter. Those things didn't matter to Suna. What mattered was humanity. And as we exuded the teachings that came through us, she wholeheartedly embraced it out of respect. And we respected each other for that, not trying to make each other of the other religion, no. We got to Benghazi. Again, the generals were running. And I said, they asked, when are we leaving? I said, not now. We're going to work in Benghazi hospital for another day. The next day, we left. And the moment we left, an hour later, sniper fire came through the same windows where my whole team was standing. An hour later. And again, they wanted to know, how did you know? And again, I said, I don't know how I know. It just happened that we had to move. The inspiration came, we had to move at that time. And Suna again was open to those kind of messages. What is this? And the spirituality just grew in Suna all the time. In Libya, again, when things got very tense, when things got very hectic, a bomb fell in the building next door. She was busy interviewing Levan Torino. She didn't even flinch. The bomb went, she didn't even flinch. That's part of life. I'm here to cover the story. I need to tell the story of the people. I need to say what's going on in Libya. The bomb went, boom, and she carried on writing the story while everybody else was flinching. And then they gave her name in Libya. They called her Captain Jack. Now, apparently, it's named after some song. As I said, a lot of things I didn't know because they had interaction. I was too busy coordinating things. And I don't get too personally involved in all the teams and the journalists. I stay at a distance because my job is to focus on the mission. And she would hum the song, apparently. Every time there was tension, there was difficulty, so now let's hum the song, Captain Jack. Maybe the parents know the song. I don't know the song. But that's what the team said about Suna. Then came the great difficulty. She wanted to come to Syria. 25th April 2010, I was taking 77 people across to Syria. I get Suna's name was on the list. She was on my list for Libya. She was on my list for Gaza. And she was on my list for any other mission that she wanted to go. But of course, the decision comes from Futa Kriha and from RSG because they have to give every journalist a chance. So I said, if Suna wants to come, she's a brilliant journalist, and I want her with me if you want to send her. So she's on the team. I got a call two weeks prior to that from Angie Kaplianis to say, do you know that Suna is not well? So I said, when you say not well, is it a flu? Is it some diarrhea? Is it something like that? She says, no. It's far more than that. And when she explains to me, I said, look, we'll have to break Suna's heart. She cannot come on this mission. Because Suna had already reported on the war in Syria from Damascus when the war had already started. She went in alone in 2011 from the Damascus side. She now wanted to come in from the north because she was passionate about the Syrian people and the Middle East. And she was ready to take the risk to come inside. Like the bombs didn't worry her in Libya, they were not going to worry her in Syria. She wanted to come. And I broke the message to Angie. And Suna called me. She said, but why? Why can't you take me? I said, Suna, the type of condition that you have, and I'm not going to talk about the condition, it's very private. The type of condition that you have does not allow you to enter a war zone. The type of condition that you have will aggravate your condition inside Syria. And then us, instead of looking after the people inside Syria, We'll have to worry about looking after you. It could be very risky for you, the rest of the journalists and my team. We can't afford to have a broken link in the chain. I don't allow that. As close as you are to me, the mission comes first and your health comes first. I'm sorry. I can't take you. She was very upset about it, but I said, I give you my promise. If ever you, whenever you heal and you're ready, and I take another mission into Syria, your name will be the first on the list. I couldn't fulfill that promise because 29 June 2017, Suna, in her young life, was gone. And many times I went to Joburg, saw in the hospital, she would send me a message and ask for spiritual advice. What do you think? And I would send her messages and she would communicate with me. Here we had very intense spiritual discussion, not religious discussion. Spiritual discussion because it covers all religion. It was about life, about humanity, about human beings, about psychology. And we interacted beautifully. And every time I got a chance, I went to SABC not to do an interview, because those I do thousands of. I wasn't interested in interviews. I was interested in this young Afrikaner girl who committed her life to tell the story about people she had no connection with. Not the same religion, not the same race, and yet the whole world thinks of us as terrorists. They think of us as murderers, as crazy people, as fundamentalists. But here was this Afrikaner journalist who didn't see that way. She saw it for what it was, that a couple of thousand people cannot condemn an entire religion because of the bad behavior of a couple of thousand people. And she saw it for that. And that's the message she wanted to give to her people when she said that. But she saw it and she experienced it. And that's something that I loved her for. And then one day we found out that she had a tattoo on her arm. The tattoo was, "Were you brave? Were you brave?" Again, challenging everything in life, questioning herself, am I brave enough? She was part of the SABC 8. Brave enough to challenge authority. She said she was threatened. I didn't get that from her directly, but it was mentioned. But Suna was not afraid to challenge authority, not for the wrong reason, but for what she believed in. Now, you may say what she believed in may be wrong, but from her point of view and her perception, it was correct. So if any, in our religion, your actions are judged by your intention, are judged by your intention. So if your intention is to do good, even if it's a mistake, you are rewarded for being good because your intention is about a good thing. People may perceive it as wrong and everybody else may see it as wrong. But if in your mind it's about a good thing, we regard it as good. So Suna perceived that to challenge authority in that case and in Gaza and in Libya and wherever she went to challenge what was wrong for not herself. Remember, it was not for herself. There was no personal gain. Suna did it for the sake of other people. In the process, she could have lost. She could have lost her life. She could have lost her limb. She could have lost her eye. She could have been broken from a family member. But she challenged it because she believed in what was right. It was not about the story. It was never about the story. It was always about the situation of the people inside the story. And that's why she endeared herself so much to my teams that they only called two journalists, sometimes three. Strangely enough, also Afrikaner. When the teams had functions in Joburg, the medical teams, they called Suna, Erika Gibson, and Janine Kutze. Janine Kutze is Channel Africa. Erika Gibson was BL, Report, and now Network 24. So from those three journalists were always invited to the medical team. And there's only a core medical team of six people. And Asad Borat, who has now moved to Australia, went and saw Suna in hospital before he left. She was in hospital in January 2017. And she went and saw before he went home. And at that point, she told him she would like to be the media person for Gift of the Givers. So, Asad said, talk to him when you are ready. And her last statement on her Facebook page, I'm not on social media, so I don't read all these things. But she told, Asad told me, her last message on the social media page was, my heart signs more checks than I can cash. Her life, my heart signs more checks than I can cash. Her love for the world of people in difficulty was so intense that she couldn't serve everybody fast enough because the disease robbed her of being a great journalist. She was in front of the TV and she blanked out. Live on TV. She couldn't read the words. The disease that did that to her. A promising career was destroyed on TV and radio. But it never destroyed Suna's spirit. I always told Suna, one day you're going to be a great journalist. She was already a great journalist. But as you grow older, people recognize you more. And when those things happen, Suna never gave up fighting. And that month before I sent her that message, "Hi, Suna, I hope you're fine. I'm in Bramley." Because the last visit when I sent her the message, I was very excited for her. And the parents would know that. She said, "I'm moving house." And once she sent me a message, "I'm driving again." Now, to drive, is that a great deal? Everybody drives. 13-year-olds drive today. Without licenses too. Yeah. And she said, "I'm driving again." Do you know what that means to a person whose disease is destroying your physical and mental being? For you to drive again means you are mobile, you are able, you are empowered, you can move to areas, and you can do a lot of things, in her case. And then she sent me another message. "I'm so sorry I can't see you today. I'm moving house today." And I said, "Suna, I am so happy for you. There'll be a next time. On the next visit, I will see you." And the next visit was 29 June 2017. Man plans and God disposes. But Suna has not left us. She is in our heart 24/7. I still have a picture on my WhatsApp and the words are still there. "Hi, Suna. I hope you're fine. I'm in Bramley, 1227. That picture with Suna is still on my phone. It won't leave, like Yolande Kock's picture won't leave my phone. It will always be there. Because these are special people in your heart. They've filled up a special place in your heart. My wife said, when I sat next to Suna on the bus to Gaza, I could see that this young Afrikaner girl was very intense, asked a lot of questions, wanting to know, wanting to get the truth, wanting to know about life in general. And she said, even in my mind, I perceived that just journalists was going somewhere very, very far. Philip and Krista, you may have lost, and the son and a daughter-in-law, you may have lost a daughter to yourself. But remember, you've gained a world of friendship. Suna is in everybody's hearts. Again, when I told them I'm coming to do this lecture, they were all just singing about Suna. They all cried. My teams cried the day it happened. They said, "How is this possible? Are you sure? Has this really happened? Has Suna gone?" These were Muslim boys crying for a Christian girl. You don't hear that normally. Because she stole everyone's hearts. They were Muslim boys who invited Suna to their homes. The father can and mother can tell you that. Because she stole their heart. Wherever we went, they would say, "Call Suna." When Shiraz Muhammad disappeared on January 10, 2017, inside Syria, Suna was the first one to send me a message. "You know, Dr. Suleiman, because of Imtiaz, I know Shiraz personally. What can I do? You want me to arrange extraction teams?" Suna was very dramatic. "You want me to arrange extraction teams?" I said, "Suna, this is not the movie. You have no idea what's going on in Syria. Even Syrians don't know what's going on in Syria. How are you going to arrange extraction teams to take Shiraz out?" Then she would send me a message. "A lot of people are saying negative things." I said, "Suna, you know me by now. It comes here, it doesn't even penetrate, it bounces and it goes off. I really don't care what people say. Because everything is by intention. Actions are but by intention. Our job is to save Shiraz. And 9 January this year, or 8 January this year, we got proof of life exactly 1 year later. And I so miss Suna. I was going to send Suna a message. "Suna, thank you for being there for Shiraz and his family. We got proof of life." On the 8th of January, Suna came to my mind again because she was the one that stood for Shiraz, for other journalists, for people in difficulty, anywhere in the country, anywhere in the world. A lot of people didn't understand her. A lot of people didn't understand Suna. But all the people who understood spirituality understood who Suna is. We pray for a soul to be in a contented and a resting place. And we pray that God Almighty bless her with the best in the year after. But Suna's memory will never be forgotten. And today's lecture in Stellenbosch is to rekindle and remember the memory. Suna was a great person. We loved her. Thank you very much. Okay. Gift of the Givers was formed on the 6th of August, 1992. I was on a visit to Istanbul. And strangely enough, the Afrikaners keep coming to my life. I'm from Potchefstroom. My neighbors are Afrikaners. And in 1986, I moved from Durban to Maritzburg. I had finished internship. And this Afrikaner guy meets me. He needs a doctor. He's from Pretoria. He comes to Maritzburg. He's going to teach French in the university. But he has a persistent headache problem. He was a real headache. I always should tell him that. I said, Mr. Muller, you got a problem all the time. But we became very, very close. Again, the connection was spiritual. He told me I was in America for many years, and I met a great spiritual Turkish teacher, but he passed on in 85, and I'm in Maritzburg in 86. He said, but there's a new one. He said, you must go to Turkey and meet this man. So we engaged each other. So I said, Mr. Muller, you know what? Very all in good. I have to go to Turkey. It's 1986. I haven't seen Cape Town yet. Then he said something very profound. He said, what God wills will happen. In 91, the mission came. It's a long story. But I arranged SAS Drakensberg, what government and F.W. de Klerk and Pugbota, to take a ship of aid to Bangladesh. On that mission, I had to go to Turkey because we were dropping trucks off for the Turkish Red Crescent to move goods to Kurdistan. On that mission, for the first time, my wife and I met the spiritual teacher. Now, what was very interesting about this meeting, it came after the Gulf War. It came while we were in a state of apartheid in South Africa. So remember, it's stereotypes. We are polarized. We look at different religions and different colors in a very jaundiced way, generalizing about everything. And I go to a Muslim spiritual place, and I see people from all religions, Christians, Jews, Hindus, Blacks, Whites, Australians, Americans, Germans, everybody, all in harmony in a Muslim holy place. And I can't understand this because we've bombed each other in all parts of the world. And I can't understand this. The spiritual teacher looks at my face and he can see the shock on my face. I'm telling my wife, I think we came to the wrong place. I can't understand this. We're not fighting with each other. Everybody's in harmony here. What's going on? The teacher perceived my soul immediately. Same, the first words that came out from his mouth, my son. I understood, my son. I've never met this guy in my life before. What do you see? I said, I see people of all religion, all cultures, all countries in the Muslim holy place. But I see them at peace with each other. He goes on to say, my son, mankind is one single nation. The God of all mankind is one. We just call him by different names. The bad actions of a group of people is not indicative of a whole religion or a whole nation. It's indicative of those people moving away from religion. He said, any person, irrespective of his external paraphernalia, no matter what book he's holding in his hand, be he an imam, a sheikh, a rabbi, a priest, a pandit, if he promotes violence, extremism, terrorism, the taking of life, he's not a man of God. Don't follow him. Any person who promotes love, kindness, compassion, and human dignity, that is a man of God. Follow him. I fell in love. I went back this following year, 6 August 1992, 10 p.m., Thursday night. In Islam, the Friday starts on Thursday. The day always starts the day before. Because for us, the new day starts at sunset. But the sunset prayer, it's the next day. So Thursday sunset is Friday. And Friday sunset is Saturday. For us, Friday is a very important time. So Thursday night after sunset is a very important time. Many of the religious groups in Islam do, in Sufism, it's one branch of Islam, we do what is called a zikr. A zikr is a recitation of God's names. In English, you would say, the one and only, kind, compassionate, eternal, loving, most kind, most gracious, a whole lot of attributes. So we announce them in a certain way. We pronounce them and read them in a certain way. When we finished 10 o'clock that night, The spiritual teacher is in that corner. I'm here. He suddenly looks me straight in the eye. I can see him looking at me, but I can see he's also connecting heavenwards. So he's with me and he's not with me. He says in fluent Turkish, "I don't understand a word of Turkish, but I understood every single word that he said." He said, "My son, I'm not asking you. I'm instructing you to form an organization. The name in Arabic will be Waqful Waqifin. Translated, it means gift of the givers. You will serve all people of all races, of all religions, of all colors, of all classes, of all cultures, of any geographical location and of any political affiliation. But you will serve them unconditionally. You will not expect anything in return, not even a thank you. In fact, in what you're going to be doing for the rest of your life, expect to get a kick up your back. If you don't get a kick up your back, regard that as a bonus. Serve people with love, kindness, compassion, and mercy. And remember, the dignity of man is foremost. So if somebody's down on the ground, don't push them down further. Hold them, lift them, bring them up. Wipe the tear of a grieving child. Caress the head of an orphan. Say words of good counsel to a widow. These things are free. They don't cost anything. Clothe the naked, feed the hungry, and provide for water for the thirsty. And in everything that you do, be the best at what you do. Not because of ego, because you're dealing with human emotion, human suffering, human life, and human dignity. This is an instruction for you for the rest of your life. And whatever you do, remember, is done through you and not by you. Don't ever forget that. In everything, you will know what to do as long as you believe in this and follow this. And on one occasion, I've been to Turkey 22 times. On one occasion, I asked him, "Teacher, how come when you speak Turkish, I understand everything that you say? Whenever anybody else speaks to me in Turkish, I don't understand anything that they say." He says, "My son, when the hearts and the souls connect, the words make sense. No matter what language you use. Every time I went there, I understood every single thing he said. Nobody had to translate for me." The first mission was Bosnia. 25 years, we've been to 43 countries. Different types of missions. Earthquake in Haiti, earthquake in India, earthquake in Nepal, the drought and floods in Malawi, Mozambique, we have Zimbabwe. We've been to the Philippines, Syria, Yemen, Gaza, Iran earthquake. We've been to so many different places, all kinds of difficulty. The DRC, Rwanda, Congo, Republic of Congo, Niger, famine, starvation, floods, hurricanes, war, every kind of difficulty, different types of teams. And my team is completely mixed. Black, white, Christian, people who say they don't even believe, everybody is welcome. The teacher said, "We don't judge anybody. We invite everybody. We accept everybody the way they are unconditionally. And we only show love, compassion, and mercy, and we embrace everyone." Those are the international missions. Locally, what has propelled us into the headlines in the last 2 years, we started off with the fire in Hout Bay in January, March last year. The big one that opened everybody's eyes who we are was Nizhna. The response in Nizhna was total, a total disaster response. Sending in a whole team with search and rescue personnel for fire, sending in a medical team, sending in advanced life support ambulances, teams to distribute food, blankets, and water. We did bee rehabilitation. 22 million bees died in the fire. We are actively involved in bee rehabilitation in Nizhna right up till now. Then they said the pets are hungry, so we sent in pet food. Then the farmers got to us and said the drought has affected our animals. Before the fire came in Nizhna, there was drought, so the animals are dying, there's no fodder. From August last year till December last year, we sent in 40 million rand worth of fodder to farmers all over northern, southern, and eastern Cape. 200 trucks, not my fault. All this came from Afrikaner farmers. The Afrikaner farmers from all over the country stood with each other as human beings, and they gave free fodder for the other farmers. They could have taken the sheep at half the price or taken the cattle at half the price, but they didn't do that. They sent fodder all over. Transnet gave us 4 trains to supply fodder to the farmers all over. And we sent in 200 trucks of aid. A lot of that, we covered the cost. So we did fodder. And then they said the wild animals in the bush need food, so we sent animal food for the wild animals. Then they say the National Elephant Park requires food, so we send food for the National Elephant Park also. I said, what else do you need? So every kind of disaster approach, they needed to move the patients from Nizer Hospital to George, we sent in teams for that too. It was a complete disaster response, and we started rebuilding houses also in Nizer. And then, of course, came Beaufort West, the provincial disaster, Western Cape Pallas. I said, Beaufort West is about to get dry. All the specialists say there's no water. Again, the Afrikaner comes to the help. The Boer always makes a plan, you see. Dr. Grinien Groenewald, master hydrologist from Free State University, brother from Cape Town office, is sitting in a meeting in Beaufort West with all the hydrologists and engineers. And they said they can't find water. I said, don't worry about anybody. Just call this man, Grinien Groenewald. God had it, he was in Worcester. He comes to Beaufort West. Within 21 days, he finds 1 million liters of water a day. But we cut the water to give out 250,000 liters a day because the aquifer was not recharging. And you can't destroy the aquifer. I just met him now before I came here. He said the aquifers are recharging and the water levels are rising inside those bowls, inside Beaufort West. That put us on the map, and then eventually the Western Cape drought. We are the only agency in partnership to the Western Cape provincial government, the national and provincial disaster, to the local municipalities, and the city of Cape Town. We're moving millions of liters of water from all over the country by ship, by train, by truck, into Cape Town, into military warehouses. We're already distributing in areas because no matter if they tell you 15th of July, the reality is when supply cannot meet demand, you're already on day zero. When people don't have enough water to wash cerebral palsy patients in their homes, they are on day zero in reality. So we're rolling out bottled water, and at the same time, we're drilling balls. Dr. Groenewald has given the whole contract. We saved Beaufort West. We're saving the Duans right now. We're going to be busy in Tolsrivier, Vredendal, Bonnievale, Tulbagh, Hantum, Wuppertal. All those areas are almost dry. And we'll be putting water in all those areas. And of course, the rest of Cape Town. And then of course, Eastern Cape is also waiting. Depending on the funding, we'll go into more areas. But this drought project and the fodder has become our biggest projects. I've answered your question, I think. It's a combination of both. The spiritual teacher told me, my son, you will never have to look for anything. People from all over the country and all over the world will come to you. In 26 years, we haven't really have to look for anything. People wait in queues to work with us. We get calls from government. We get calls from corporates, from private sector, from specialists. Quite often, when we announce a project, sometimes even before we announce a project, somebody would say, I put in 50,000 into your account. I said, for what is this? No, this project, we have to start this project. I said, but I haven't announced I'm starting this project. No, but you have to start this project. We need to help you. And like that, when we announce through the media, our biggest friend is the media. RSG gives us a lot of coverage, you know, and a lot of Afrikaner people must have heard our stories many times. And when it's announced, we don't go to people for money. We don't say, please, you give me 50,000 rand. We don't. We announce our projects in the media, and inevitably, we get calls from everyone. Now, Transnet wouldn't know if we need trains. So those are special cases. We'll phone them and say, look, and that's why I'll use an Afrikaner lady who came to me and said, look, I want to work with you. I have connections with Transnet. Can I go? But you have to give us your letterhead. The moment you give them our letterhead, you got 4 trains. And you know, so it's that kind of stuff. Because our brand is so strong, people know that we work with everybody. They know we deliver. And I mean, the people on the ground are witnesses to that. When nobody wanted to go into Marikana, we moved in unarmed, where there were 70,000 people who were very angry, to deliver food to them, to calm them down. You know? And the cops told us, you guys are mad, you're going without an armed escort. We said, we know how to deal with this. And we went in, because we've been in war zones. So in that way, if you just tell Transnet, it doesn't take a long explanation to say why you want it. They understand the picture, and they will come to you. And recently, after Nizna, many, many more. It's not only now, in 2017, that the corporates are starting to come in a bigger way. Everybody thought this is a Muslim organization. They only do Muslim things. They only do international things. They don't do anything else. They never understood that. And that's Futa's fault because they don't give us enough coverage for local things. So they need to give us more coverage for local things so people can understand that. But of course, NISA just ran away with everything. And now with the Cape thing. So yes, people come. But if you explain to them your need, it's easy. I mean, now the corporates say, I got 3 million rand. I got 1 million rand. I got 2 million rand. What can you do? And everybody is looking at sustainable water projects right now. Again, it's a yes and a no. People from foreign countries, see, the media covers their own organizations in their countries. They don't cover so much about other organizations from outside countries in their country. You go into the Middle East, for example, most dangerous places we've been to, they speak Arabic only. So I haven't got a clue if anything said in English about us. It's something you have to develop a relationship with. If it's a non-war zone, it's fairly easy. Because over the last 25 years, all the embassies in South Africa know who we are. In the past, we have to phone Auf Durko to tell them, speak to the embassy to say we want to go in. Now that system doesn't apply. The embassy just phones you directly. They said, we want you to come to our country. We know what you guys can do. We'll facilitate the visas, customs free. You just come in, we'll arrange everything for you. Just come. In non-war zone situation, that's fine. In a war situation, it's far more complicated. Because if you help this guy perceives you as the enemy. If you help this guy perceives you as the enemy. So when you go to a war zone, everybody wants to shoot you. So you have to go with people. And I'll give you a classical example in Syria. When we went in for the first time, where we put up a hospital, the civilians overthrew the troops and chased them away. So it was a civilian success mission, no military. A few months later, the Free Syrian Army came there. So they're now in charge. A few months later, ISIS came into the area, 12 kilometers away from the hospital. Then they left, then Al-Qaeda came. So you can't be friends with anybody. You have to be neutral. They have to see you in action. And when they see you in action, and when they realize that if ISIS soldiers come to the hospital, Al-Qaeda soldiers come into the hospital, somebody's family come to the hospital, we don't ask any questions. Our aim is to save life. That's what medical people do in a war zone. They don't ask which side you belong to. What did you do? Did you shoot somebody? Okay, we'll treat you or we won't treat you. You don't do that. You just save life, but that's your medical job to do. So when people see that, when Al-Qaeda came, they called Jabal al-Nusra. The first thing they walked into the area, they put a flag on our hospital, Al-Qaeda flag. We told them, if that flag doesn't go down in 5 minutes, we shut this hospital down. In less than 5 minutes, that flag is off the hospital and they're anyway far from the hospital. Because they know we are neutral and we serve everybody. That's not only the organization mandate, that's a religious instruction. That even if you're fighting in a battlefront, you need to teach your enemy what kindness, don't tie them, share your food, give them full treatment like you do to your own soldier. That's a religious instruction. So we go, yes, we go into different zones, we have to negotiate our way. I'll give you another classical story. When the earthquake happened in Haiti, you could either go through America or through Europe to fly there. We said, America is not going to work. They're going to see the big beards and they're going to say, oh, all these terrorists are coming to our country. So that's not going to work. So let's go via France. So Durko called France. The French embassy was very, very cooperative. And we said, okay, we'll fly via France. And then I went to the French Air France. I said, can you get us to Haiti? They said, yes, no problem. We'll get you to Haiti. I said, the airport is going to close. They said, the airport is open. I said, it will close. No, I'll give you a guarantee in writing. We will get you there. Give me a guarantee in writing. I knew that's never going to happen. So how did we work? I phoned the Catholic Society from, I was in Marathuk. I called the Catholic Society in Joburg. I said, I need the Pope. And the guy, the other guy was, nah, do I need him for Al-Qaeda? Osama bin Laden's going to go there. What, kill the Pope? What's the story? He said, what do you need the Pope for? I said, you can't get the Pope. We Muslims, we connected all over the world. Shame on you. He said, no, don't worry, I'll get the Pope. In 3 hours, he calls me back. He said, I got the Pope. Now, what do you want? I said, I want a Catholic organization to meet my teams, not in Port-au-Prince, in Dominican Republic. Because they're never going to get to Port-au-Prince with the French airline. They don't know what they're talking about. So he says, okay, calls me back. The Pope is arranged. You've got Catholic Relief Services and Caritas. The Catholic organizations will meet you in the ground in Dominican Republic. My guys land in France and they said, we can't fly to Paris, to Port-au-Prince. I said, I know that already. I told Air France it's never going to happen. In the meantime, Air France gets back to me. They said, we can't fly you to Port-au-Prince. I said, I told you that yesterday. But can you fly them to Dominican Republic? Yes, in 2 hours, there's another flight. So when they got off the ground, the tickets were already booked on Dominican Republic. And when they got to Dominican Republic, Caritas and Catholic Daily Services, gift that they give us from South Africa, we are here to receive you. Accommodation, food, water, visas, and they took them across into Port-au-Prince and they kept them in their compound. It was people of different religions working together. We bypassed the difficulty. There was not a war zone, but they were shooting in the streets because of looting, because people were hungry. So there was all uncontrollable violence, and Caritas kept our teams in their compound. And I said, we must have an organization that's respected in the country in peacetime. In wartime, nobody will touch them. Nobody interfered with Caritas compound because they were respected in peacetime. So our teams, when other teams were working 3 hours a day, our teams worked 9 hours a day. And we made a world first in Haiti. It was the first time in the world that an African team found somebody alive in the rubble in an earthquake outside the African continent. It was 8 days later, 20th January 2010, when we found 64-year-old Enna Zizi inside the church. And the moment she came up, the first word she said is, I love God. So you can imagine instilling hope in people so many thousands of kilometers away. I think you guys are tired now. My full-time team is paid staff. I don't want any volunteers for my full-time work. Because Monday morning, they promise you coming, and then, oh, my, I got a toothache. I'm going to the dentist. And they mess your whole mission up. But my disaster missions are all volunteers because I don't need them all the time. When we started the first team, the first time we started off was in 2004. We responded to a place called Hafun in Somalia when the tsunami hit the whole world, affected Somalia also. So the first people who came, few people came, they started the core team. And as they came back, they said what a great experience we had. And then more people came for the next mission and the next mission. From there, we started sorting out. And we built a core team of 30 people, of which Suna was a part of those 30 people. She knew who they were. She met them all the time. And even when we were not on missions, I should call meetings in Bramley, and Suna would come there. So Suna knew those core people. So they are core people, and in any mission, they are the first one. Not because they're necessarily highly skilled. Yes, they're all highly skilled, but I don't take them for that reason. I take them because they have the right temperament. Can you get along with a white guy? Can you get along with a black guy? Can you get along with a Christian? Can you get another one who's going to say, I don't believe in God, or you're going to get all emotional and, you know, and freak out. And say, no, how can you say you don't believe in God? You know, you need people who have the right temperament. If a bomb falls next to you, will you be able to calm the next people? Because I had some crazy people who came with me to Syria. The first team came, and then the second team came. Now, this guy was a new guy. He came on a mission, so he said, how's it here? Is it dangerous? So the other guy, just joking, because in war situation, you tell a lot of jokes to relieve the stress. He said, no, it's not so bad. Now and then the missile just flies past you. And the guy said, are you serious? This missile really flies past you? He said, I'm only joking. Of course, missiles hit the hospital, above the hospital. Four missiles hit above the hospital. So we've built a core team and people around that core team. When I say medical, it's not necessarily doctors only. It depends on the type of mission. If it's a primary healthcare mission, if it's famine, you can't take a surgeon. You take pediatricians, dietitians, ordinary nurses, primary health care nurses, that kind of stuff, and general doctors, GPs, they can do a lot of work. In trauma situations, in earthquake, in war, you take general surgeon, orthopedic surgeon, vascular surgeon, anesthetist, ICU specialist, people like that. Then you need ICU nurse, you need a matron. In Syria, because we set up a hospital, I took a lady who was like a military, like a dictator. She could set up the whole hospital, tell the doctor, hey, you're affecting the sterility. You didn't put your glove on. You walked in with your shoes in the theater. You're like a real dictator. You know, so you needed people like that who can run a hospital for hygiene situations. Then you can take later on, we had physiotherapists, spinal rehab specialists. I took a lady called Karina Xtien from Pretoria University, who's a well-renowned spinal rehab specialist, and she came with me to Pakistan in Christmas. She gave up her time to be in a Muslim country. So physiotherapists, we take dentists too. In the beginning, the thinking was, in a war zone, it's all trauma. And then realize, you know what, as we evolve, no. Because yes, people do get shot and people do get bombed. But what about the guys who got diabetes, high blood pressure, they get fever, they get asthma. The war is carrying on. So the war doesn't say, okay, the hypertension doesn't say, okay, after the war, I'll come back. I'll wait for the war to be over. And then we found that in Syria, Futa was there, more than 400 patients a day were patients like this, more than a trauma. They needed simple care, wound dressing, mosquito bite, insect bite, that kind of stuff. So the teams are very, very mixed. But it's all related to the medical field. No, but that's not in the war zone. That's very local. But you'll be surprised, we got called from Spain, or was it Portugal when they had the big fires. And they sent us a message to say, how do you rehabilitate the bees? And the guy in Niza that's working with us, there's Megan Farmas, Grant Livesey, and Owen Williams. Three of them are the specialists, and I put them in touch with the people in Portugal about how to deal with the bees. And then we got a call from Eastern Cape also, how to deal. These guys are absolutely passionate about bees. And you know, That's what you love about it. When I went, it's also a strange story. When I got to Knysna, this guy walks into the Checkers warehouse and says, I need sugar. So I said, did you not get sugar in your food parcel yesterday? So I asked my people, why you didn't give him sugar? They said, we ran out. So I said, but Checkers said, come take it whenever you want it. So we said, yeah, it's coming. So I said, okay, did you not get this in your food parcel? He says, it's not for me. So I said, is it for your friend? No, it's for the bee. I'm thinking, what the hell is wrong with this hoe? So I said, what do you mean it's for the bee? He said, the bees died here. And then we need to draw them back. And we need to give them a solution that's sugar. It's not ideal. It's not proper bee food. But under the circumstances, everything is burnt out. So I said, okay, how much sugar you need? So he says, look, there's a lot of bees. I phoned Mesmat. They sent me 30 tons of sugar the next day. But then I told the guy, you know what? I need to know about this, more about this bees business. So Friday morning, I meet him again. He brings Megan and Owen, and we start talking about the bees. So I said, I like to see the bees. I don't know, I opened my mouth for the wrong reason. I go to the area, I said, now you have to see the bee, you have to wear this bee outfit. I'm thinking of these bloody things that are going to sting me now, and I'm going to wear this outfit. I can't go and see these bees. But then I put the outfit on. I went to the bees, and believe me, it's the greatest spiritual experience I've ever had. You watch the bees, you see the pictures on Discovery, and those big honeycomb things. I saw this live, and the bees are very calm. If you don't interfere with them, they won't interfere with you. And the moment they open the box, they screamed in excitement. There's the queen bee. We haven't seen a queen bee in a long time. You've brought luck to this place. And how the bees were working, and the way they were working in nature, I just fell in love with them. And I realized, you know what? We're going to take this project on. They needed 300 beehives. They needed bee food. So I said, how much do you need? They said, 10 rand for this, 20 rand for that, 50 rand for this. I said, I'll give you 250,000 rand. They all three sat down and they started crying. I said, this is only the beginning. We need to save the bees. And they're doing a magnificent job. Soon I would have loved this. Just to qualify, we don't do individual assistance. We're only specifically in that case. That started off in 2011 when Bruno and what's Debbie? Yeah, Debbie, they got caught, taken by Somali pirates. And at that time, we had opened up, everybody was leaving Somalia. The bombing was too intense between the Al-Shabaab and the government. But there was a huge famine there. Once everybody was leaving, I took a team of 60 people into Somalia. We took in 200 containers of aid and 13 planes. We flew into Somalia. So when Debbie's family heard about, and Bruno's family heard, it was actually Bruno's sister, heard about what we were involved in, they said, can you find, help us with trying to locate my brother and his fiancée? So my guy on the ground, Somali people are very good at making networks. So I told my guy, I said, look, we haven't done this before. It doesn't harm to get any information. Within a few days, we traced where they were picked up, where they went to, who took them, who changed the ship, who sold them to where and where they gone. We picked up all that information and we passed it on to them. They decided to go their own way, end of story. A few weeks later, the Taiwanese government called us. 30 of our sailors are missing. Can you help? Same thing. We did information. We investigated. We called them back. We said, do you know your 30 sailors have just been released? We told the embassy. They said, no, we haven't been told that information yet. I said, somebody in your country paid. They released on their way home. And that happened. We got that information. Then in 2013, it was immediately after we went to Syria, 25th May. We came back on the 25th of April. Not 25th April. We came back on the 10th of May. On the 25th of May, the guy from Yemen, open office in Yemen, Anas, the guy who spoke for Yolandi, he gets home from Syria. I took him to Syria. I said, Anas, you knew what us. You need to learn everything about how we do things. You're a journalist. You speak Arabic. You need to learn how we run our operations. So you please come from Yemen. And I took him to Syria. He phones me on the 25th. He said, did you hear? A South African couple has been captured in Yemen. So I said, yeah, it's in South African newspaper today. So he said, okay, what do we do? Do we help? I said, Anas, our logo says best among people are those who benefit mankind. I think it fits within that statement. So let's just do it. We've got nothing to lose. It's a long story. But that's how we got Yolandi out. And Pierre was secured to come out, and on the 6th, Americans went in. When it came to McGowan, Malcolm came to me whilst I was busy with Pierre Corky. He said, Dr. Suleiman, I've tried everybody. Stephen got taken in 2011. And he said, no, it's not 2011. Yeah, 2011, yeah, 2011, November 25th. And he says, you know what? Nobody can help me. Can you help? But I can't interfere now because I know you're busy with Pierre Corky. So I said, Malcolm, my biggest problem is going to be I got nobody in Mali. In Yemen, I got leverage. The government, the state security, all the groups, everybody knows us because our operations are everywhere in Yemen. So everybody knows who's gift of the givers. In Mali, we don't know anybody. So I can't promise you anything. 6 December came, Pierre passed on. My office manager from Joburg was going to Mauritania because we got an operation there. So I said, look, Malcolm, we'll try to Mauritania. It's nearby. That's the best we can do. Came back, total failure. We couldn't achieve anything. June 23, 2015, we saw the video. I just had the TV on in the morning and I suddenly saw this video. I phoned Malcolm. I said, Malcolm, this video is telling me Al-Qaeda wants to negotiate. We'll see what we can do. But I got nobody in Mali. So I went on radio and TV that morning, announced that we're going to help Malcolm. And I said, I announced it on radio and TV. If there's any Mali guy here who wants to help us in Mali, please come forward. 3 hours later, the guy walks into the office. I'm Mohamed Yahya Diko. I'm from Mali. I live in South Africa so many years. I want to help you. No money, no payment, nothing. Just to do a good deed. I said, what do you know in Mali? My people are in the rebel groups. I know the different tribes. I have people in government. I have people on the ground. I know the area as well. I can go here, there, and everywhere. I said, your wife will give you permission? He said, yes, my wife is actually telling me to go. My wife is sending me to go. We sent him across. I said, Yahya, the first principle is people have to see you visibly. You're not a spy. You're not the intelligence service. They need to know you are. You've got to wear my green shirt. You've got to walk, go drive everywhere in Mali. North, south, east, west. Just be visible. Ask questions loudly. Say you are a negotiator. You come to look for the South African and the Swedish guy. So he started doing that. And then eventually he got led from one door to another door. And eventually he got the right guy, the intermediary from that side. And the next day they told him, but we don't see your face on the website. The groups are saying, the captors are saying, we don't see your face on the website. Are you really representing this hostage family? But I'd already told my people, put it on the website because I know that's why I made a press release to put him on the website before he goes there. But that's why I know they monitor the media. That's why the media, people don't know. I'm not talking to the South African public. I'm talking to the captors when I'm in the media. I'm giving them information, but you have to be consistent. And then we just rearranged the links to put it right in their face. So the next day they went, oh no, we see all the articles. Yes, you are the guy. We accept you to be the negotiator. This guy left his business. He went up for 3 or 4 days. He landed up there for 3 weeks. He went almost 8 times to Mali. He went right in the north. At one point where he got there, he told them, it's possible the guy standing next to you is Al-Qaeda. It's possible Stephen and Juan is around the corner from where you are. But we can't really tell you that. And that's how close. And then at one point, when they were going in on the ground, the French troops were coming on the other side. And the guy, instead of turning right and going, he was driving towards the French troops. They almost got bombed in the process. One of the key people he met inside one of the cities, he moved out. It's 2 hours later, and he moved out. That whole house got bombed. But in spite of all that, he took the risk and he went in many, many times. So it's people who commit their heart to doing this kind of job. That's why we're so successful.